Let's go next to Arizona, where 98 patients approved for organ transplants have been told they're not getting transplants. The patients are on Arizona's version of Medicaid, and the state is trying to close a big budget deficit. NPR's Ted Robbins has this report on what's being called an unprecedented denial of medical service.
Whoa! Right up the middle. Nice one.
Randy Shepard is 36 years old and 6'3", but he has to toss baseballs to his 3-year-old son Nathan while sitting down in a lawn chair. He has cardiomyopathy. His heart muscle is deteriorating. It's the result of rheumatic fever he had as a child. He had his heart valves replaced as a teenager, but that was 20 years ago.
The muscles gotten tired and distended, and the muscles worn out.
You can hear the weakness in his voice, even though doctors implanted a pacemaker in 2008. They've told Randy Shepard that he needs a heart transplant to survive. ACCESS, the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, is the state's Medicaid program. It was the only health insurance Shepard could get because he had a pre-existing condition and he had little money since he was forced to stop working in his plumbing business. ACCESS authorized his transplant more than a year ago.
July 23rd of 09 was the date they officially put me on the list.
And by this summer, he'd moved up to the top of the transplant list.
My nurse, who's the transplant coordinator, did tell me about 2 months ago that I'm the next one of my body size and blood type, so the next one that's available is mine.
It was his. Facing $1.5 billion budget deficit, Arizona cut out all state-funded lung transplants, some bone marrow transplants, and some heart transplants, including for the condition Randy has.
Well, as of October 1st, due to the budget cuts, ACCESS has said they're unable to pay for the transplant.
It's not unusual for private insurance companies or government agencies to change eligibility requirements for medical procedures ahead of time. But medical ethicists say authorizing a procedure, then reversing that decision, is unheard of.
To basically renege on what you promised was going to be a chance at life is a very, very bitter indictment of the ethics of the legislature.
Arthur Kaplan is head of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He calls the reversal awful behavior because Arizona is going back on a covenant it made with its patients. And also, he says, because these are patients for whom time is critical, patients who spent months, years, thinking they were covered.
They then stop trying to raise money, stop trying to see what Uncle Fred might be willing to give them. They don't have the bake sale. They don't make the appeal in church.
The state says the cuts will save about $4.5 million this year. No one from ACCESS would agree to an interview, but the state agency provided us with the data it gave to the legislature. It shows the procedures have poor outcomes, that most patients die after the transplants. But critics say that data was cherry-picked. It only included ACCESS's own patients and only for a 2-year period. A coalition of transplant centers, including the University of Arizona and the Mayo Clinic, recently gave the state more data showing better outcomes. State Representative John Kavanaugh is on the House Appropriations Committee in the Arizona Legislature. He looked at the new information.
It's a terrible situation, but we don't want anybody to die because of a faulty data set. So if we made a mistake, then we're going to reinstate those that require it.
Kavanaugh is promising a hearing when the Arizona legislature convenes in January. He says the state can cut money somewhere else. Meanwhile, one patient has found a private bone marrow donor. Randy Shepard says he and his wife were bitter when they first learned approval for his new heart was taken away. But they've learned to appreciate the time and the medical procedures he's already had.
If I were to die because they didn't give me the transplant, I've had the last 18 months with my kids that I would not have had otherwise because ACCESS paid for my pacemaker.
Now on disability through Social Security, Randy Shepard will become eligible for Medicare next year. That gives him some hope, whatever the Arizona legislature does. 96 other patients wait. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
Ted's one of scores of NPR correspondents you hear from across America on Morning Edition from NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We'll report next on the story of one unemployed American. It's a story you could likely repeat millions of times.
The upside for Americans out of work right now is that companies are slowly hiring again. The downside is that Americans out of work may not be at the front of the line for those new jobs.
The very fact of being unemployed may be a disadvantage. Some employers are not eager to hire the close to 25 million Americans who are out of work or underemployed. That includes this experienced worker who spoke with NPR's John Itzde.
Until he got laid off more than 2 years ago, Michael Hall was a road warrior.
I would leave my home here in California about 3 a.m. To catch a flight and get home Friday around midnight.
In between, he'd often make 8 more airline connections as he flew around the country.
Yeah, pretty hardcore.
Hall's job was demonstrating high-tech equipment for data and phone networks. His hard work, engineering training, and social skills helped him pull down a solid six-figure income. But now Mike Hall, who's 50 years old and single, spends most of his time looking for work. He says he's applied for well over 1,000 jobs. Every 3 months or so, he manages to get an interview, but so far, no luck. He says he knows it's not personal.
But try telling that to some kid who asked every single girl to the prom in his high school. And they all said no. After a while, being told that you're not desired or wanted that many times, it might start to sink in, but you try to block it out.
Hall says he mostly manages to remain hopeful, but he's really troubled by one thing: the prejudice many hiring managers seem to hold against the unemployed.
Two specifically came right out and said, we don't like to hire people that are unemployed. And one followed that with, so why are you still unemployed, in almost an indignant manner, which seemed kind of insulting. And the obvious answer is, well, because people like you don't like to hire unemployed people.
This is a common complaint from unemployed workers, that employers only want to hire people who already have jobs. And there's a view that there must be something wrong with you if you're unemployed. Chris Schaublock, CEO of West Coast Careers, a recruiting and staffing company, confirms those perceptions. And he says he absolutely has clients who tell him they don't want him to hire unemployed workers. Schaublock thinks there are legitimate reasons behind that strategy.
If you think about the talent in that unemployed market, you would realize that companies rarely lay off their best skilled workers.
So, says Schaublock, it's not surprising that some companies don't want to hire the unemployed.
It's people that aren't top performers. So if you're ABC Corporation and you're trying to hire the best salesperson out there and you're looking at unemployed people, it might not be the group of people with the best skills.
Mike Hall says when he hears that, it makes him feel like an outcast.
It sounds and it really feels like society wants you to voluntarily walk out onto the ice floe. And I'm not ready for that. I'm too young to pack it all in. I've got a lot yet to offer.
In fact, some other staffing experts have pointed out that given the massive layoffs in the economy, the chances of finding top performers in the current pool of unemployed workers is probably higher than at any time in recent memory. And there may be another reason for companies to make sure they consider the unemployed.
It's possible that discriminating against somebody because they're unemployed is illegal.
Judy Conte represents the National Employment Law Project, an advocacy group for low-income and unemployed workers. She acknowledges there's no specific statute protecting unemployed individuals, but Conte says because people of color who are protected against discrimination have higher than average unemployment rates, an argument could be made that refusing to consider unemployed people for jobs is illegal.
With record high levels of unemployment and with people being out of work for so long now, clearly this problem and this prejudice is growing.
Conte's organization has brought the issue to the attention of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and she says the Black and Hispanic caucuses are also preparing letters urging the commission to take quick action on the issue. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
One potential consequence of losing your job is losing your home. And in Congress yesterday, you could hear an expression of the emotion brought on by home foreclosures. Members of the Senate Banking Committee berated bank executives. They complained about faulty paperwork affecting foreclosures and home loan modifications. And the lawmakers weren't the only ones complaining. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
This was the latest in some 80 hearings on the issue of housing since that market started going south several years ago. And banking chairman Christopher Dodd tried at the outset to make sure this one would proceed in a civil way.
Let me assure everyone here that I don't want this hearing to be simply about casting blame.
But even before the banking executives sat down, things were not going their way. In the morning, a congressional oversight panel released a scathing indictment of the banking industry's rubber-stamping practices on foreclosure documents. The report said it's unclear how big the problem is, but went on to highlight a worst-case scenario, saying the bank's shoddy paperwork, such as failing to properly record ownership of a home, raises questions about whether Wall Street might still have billions of bad assets on its books, or whether the government's attempts to modify home loans were based on bad information, and even whether homeowners who purchased foreclosed homes might now have to unravel those deals. The bank executives in charge of foreclosure operations said, time and again, that they consider it good business not to foreclose when possible, and they admitted their errors and apologized. Here, Barbara DeSore, president of Bank of America Home Loans.
We have an obligation to do our best to protect the integrity of the proceedings of foreclosure. And when that has not happened, we accept responsibility for it and we deeply regret it.
If banks were trying to sound conciliatory, the audience and the other panelists were not buying it. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller is heading the 50-state investigation into the bank's practices. Speaking on the panel, he criticized some banks for, among other things, advising their customers to stop making payments in order to be considered for a loan modification.
To be honest with you, some heads have to roll if they're given that kind of advice. That's just the way it is.
During Chase Home Lending CEO David Lohman's testimony, there was an outburst from the audience.
I want to emphasize that Chase strongly prefers to work with borrowers to reach a solution that permits them to keep their homes. Foreclosures cause significant hardship.
The shouting came from Bruce Marks, the outspoken housing advocate and chief of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. Marks was protesting what his group calls Chase's refusal to modify home loans for troubled homeowners. Marks was dragged out of the hearing room by security guards. Senator Dodd, with some difficulty, regained order.
All right, please. Audience, please. This is not a rally. Here's the hearing.
It was a hearing that the senators said they hoped would lead them to a solution. Yet years into this crisis, many of them said they're still getting letters from constituents complaining of wrongful foreclosures and botched loan modifications. Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley.
I have stacks of these stories. Can't we just change this policy and suspend the foreclosure proceedings when a modification is underway, not keep it going forward and create this enormous confusion and stress for America's families?
Another hearing on the same issue is scheduled in the House for tomorrow. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Today, General Motors announced it will begin selling its stock to the public for $33 a share. Trading begins tomorrow. It's one of the largest public stock offerings in history. And it will reduce the percentage of the company that's owned by the government. But for many people with close ties to GM, tomorrow will be bittersweet. The company's 700,000 retirees, active workers, and dealers get the first chance to buy the new stock, and many in that group are showing little enthusiasm for the new GM, as NPR's Sonari Glinton explains.
So far this year, GM is profitable. Part of the reason is because GM shed its most burdensome debt and obligations in bankruptcy. Sean McElinden is with the Center for Automotive Research. He says in the last 9 months, the restructured GM has shown it's a much better company.
In terms of improving vehicle price, reducing labor cost, running their plants efficiently, that's remarkable progress. And, of course, that's the progress they want to show before they sell their common stock.
McElinden says despite the last 9 months of good news, there's a but, a question any investor has to ask the new GM.
By the way, the last set of shareholders and bondholders you had, you totally screwed them. So why should I trust you now on 9 months' worth of results?
Those results come after wage concessions and benefits cuts for employees and retirees. They, along with dealers, have the right to buy up to 800 shares of the new company at the initial price. But for many, it's a tough, tough sell.
Like the Buick commercial, it's not your father's Buick anymore. It's just not GM anymore. It's now it's just another company.
I sat down with Doug Hanscom over coffee and bowls of crab chowder near the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland. Hanscom got his start 32 years ago at a GM ball bearing plant in Connecticut.
We used to fabricate the ball bearings from scratch. When the balls started coming in boxes from other plants and from Japan, we knew that the plant was destined to just shut down.
That began Hanscom's life as what he calls a GM gypsy. He worked in four states in four plants, each one he saw close. Despite the hard feelings, Hanscom says he needs GM to succeed.
They hold my pension, and I would like them to be viable and make a profit, but I just don't trust the leadership. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that everything works out, but I'm not going to buy their stock.
Hanscom says he'll wait and see. Many other retirees are definitely leaning towards buying, like John Christie. He heads GM's Retirees Association. He spent 36 years on the job. Christie says he and other retirees are willing to invest in the new GM on the hope they can get back some money they've lost on the nearly worthless old GM stock.
But as far as owning a share of a company that they put years and years of their lives into for some reason other than just financial, I really haven't heard anybody say that they really want to be part of General Motors for that reason.
There's a significant lack of love from the people that you talk to.
Yeah.
Other car stocks have rallied in recent weeks. Also, investments in GM from China and foreign sovereign wealth funds could help drive up GM stock price. David Kotok invests for large institutions and wealthy individuals. He says big Wall Street firms and foreign governments can afford to bet on GM.
There are those who think it may be an opportunity and they would speculate. And there are those who wonder whether or not the auto recovery can have enough robust activity to make the auto industry a long-term successful venture.
Kotok warns GM retirees, current workers, and average investors to remain cautious. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.